And I'm unable to take notes, so I was hoping to get a coffee shop where I could get online.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, I will not be able to revisit my role from last week.
Oh, I'm really sorry to hear that, because you did such a great job.
Thanks. That was the power of the wiki. It was so easy to just dive in and do it.
Well, I'm impressed that you can type and listen and think all at once.
Well, I did miss a few things here and there.
And being a male.
That multitasking thing is harder for our generation, or our gender, apparently.
Yes, they say that, but I know I multitask fairly regularly.
Well, listen, I'm the guy with three computers sitting here. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and a cell phone that I'm praying doesn't start to ring. But go on with what you're saying, Joe.
Okay, we were talking about the commons, and Doc has mentioned several times that the Internet doesn't really have a commons in the sense that there isn't a place where you bump into other people.
Right.
And, you know, the idea, I guess, Drummond put it in terms of the village on the mailing list, but that totally resonated back to the commons and the ability to go shopping in a commons. To me, is much more interesting than shopping, say, at a strip mall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think the community aspect of, or the village aspect of, or the commons aspect of a marketplace, I think, is a very interesting relationship dynamic that I would very much like our efforts to be able to respond to. I mean, right now there's no way to bump into someone at the checkout counter in Amazon.
True. Although, you know, the interesting thing is there's something called DAISY. I don't know if you've seen this, DAI.SY, which I have to tell you, my knee-jerk reaction to this is that I had a negative knee-jerk reaction to it, and the way they seem to be monetizing it also didn't sit well with me. But the idea is that if I join DAISY and you join DAISY and we're both at a site, we can actually interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
With the knowledge that we're both at that site, it's kind of like taking delicious and making it live and in the moment.
Right.
I mean, conceptually, I think they're on to something very good, but in execution, I was uncomfortable with what I saw. But listen, they're in beta, and I also don't know that I gave it much of a chance.
And how are they monetizing it?
Well, there's ads on the page. And the
in
way the
addition
ads,
to the ads that are already there.
Yes. The ads on the DAISY page. And I was uncomfortable with that as well. I didn't know if that was or wasn't contextual. And I also couldn't quite figure out how they could make any real money with a site like this. As a sideline, perhaps. But I didn't see it generating the sort of traffic because it's an attention issue. If your attention is on the site and interacting with other people, how can you interact or respond to an ad?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Now, could you say both of you are at Amazon? Could DAISY facilitate a conversation there? Or DAISY was just a portal that only
it's a portal that's, as I understand it, my perception is that it's a portal of an overlay sort. For instance, if we could all IM to each other, what this does is it's sort of IMing at the site, and it identifies who's at the site. You have to join DAISY in order to do that. I also felt I don't necessarily now. I know I differ from a lot of people with this. I mean, for instance, Twitter is of really no interest to me. I'm bothered enough, and I really see that as
how does Twitter work?
Twitter, people know where you are and they say what they're doing, and there's this constant flow of 140 character messages, and it has sort of, if I understand it right, there's a GPS conduit to it, and or you can say on 45th and 6th going to the bagel place, and you know all your friends and neighbors and relatives and contacts will then know this. You see, I just don't want to be that public with my life.
No.
and the
percentage of people would be low on that, too. Yeah.
And the other side of this is that if I'm, I live in the suburbs. If I'm driving into the city, I really only want people contacting me who need to contact me as opposed to contacting me because, hey, they just saw on Twitter that I'm on the Palisades Parkway on my way into the city. Hey, let me say hello to Dini's in the car. I really don't want that.
Right. And in a lot of cases, you don't even want people that you do trust knowing.
Yeah. Like
when you're going out to buy that surprise Valentine's Day gift or
right.
whatever.
Right. So, you know, there's an interesting, and we can get into a discussion of how digital natives and people of a certain age and then a whole bunch of in-betweens feel about privacy and openness and presence on the net. And this is where, again, Drummond would be his comments would be welcome on this, because I think he's probably spent more time studying this than the rest of us.
Yeah, now that's an interesting area, the whole YouTube, I don't need to be private, or the MySpace, you know, here's everything I am kind of world.
Well, there's a thought, and I think we're a little bit off VRM, we're kind of really just talking internet theory here, but there is a thought. One of the things is that digital natives are much less inclined to use email. They IM to each other, or they SMS to each other.
Right, right.
But the fact is, when they enter a certain level of maturity, be it, you know, job-based or other, email takes a certain place that IM doesn't have. While you can use Flickr and other such sites, when it's time to send pictures, sometimes you're going to send an email or a group email. And in business, we understand that in business there's a great deal of email going back and forth.
Right.
And so there's a maturity level where email re-enters the scene.
Right, although given the recentness of, you know, the developments of YouTube and MySpace, I'm not sure how much of that isn't just a manifestation of the age difference. In other words, kids who are becoming teenagers right now may not experience that transition you're talking about. It's hard for us to measure it until 10 years from now.
Well, I suspect that the way business operates, with the need to memorialize and have things legal and have a record of things, that the archiving of email, as opposed to the archiving of chat, because there's also a dynamic of chat that's different from email. I think that my suspicion, my hunch is that it will remain. It may morph and grow and evolve, but I think email per se is still the killer app and will be with us for a long time.
Right. Well, I think these are all important gestures that, you know, we need to incorporate in what we're doing with VRM. Have either of you guys played around with Eurekster?
No.
I am so frustrated by that.
So you've tried it. Now, Eurekster, if I got it right, these are the guys where you can sort of set up a search posse?
Yes, absolutely. And I have a number of blogs, one of which I'd like to commercialize, and I just cannot wrap my brain around how to make this thing work. They keep telling me it's worth like $1,500 or $2,000, and it seems to change every day. But I cannot wrap my mind around how to make this work for me. It seems it works very well for them.
So what is it called?
It's Eurekster has a product called Swikis, as in search wikis.
Yeah.
And you can say, here are terms. I have one on baseball. If you look up the national pastime on Eurekster, that's mine. And I can add, you know, for instance, I thought about this when I watched the news two nights ago. Someone else has joined us.
Hi. Hello.
And who would this be?
Yes. I'm Aaron Malhotra. I work with C4G, and it's in the VRM space. Calling from Toronto.
Okay.
C4G means Connect for Growth, so he's with me.
Ah, okay.
Good. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. So you're jumping in the middle of a conversation here, but anyway, so what I thought about all the major league teams now, and I believe the Yankees were the last holdout. I might be wrong about this, but they've taken to a new style cap that they wear at spring training, and all this really does is offer the teams a way to sell one more commercial promotional item. but the fact is, it is now pervasive for all 30 teams, and I thought, gee, should I add to my Eurekster, whatever it's called, my Swikie, should I add spring training baseball cap? And the reason I didn't is because I really cannot wrap my mind around how it works and how it's beneficial. I see people putting them on their blogs, putting the Swiki there. I see some interesting graphic ways to represent it that look pretty nice. But I just, maybe it's me, but I don't really understand or grasp how this is beneficial other than having a neat little search engine, you know, in a blog or perhaps on the site.
So you have a Swiki, or you have a blog that you were thinking about adding a Swiki to?
No, I have an existing Swiki that somehow gets hits. You know, I don't know how people find it, but they do. Maybe they go to Eurekster and see it. I haven't put it on my Dean on Baseball blog because I want to redo that and redesign that. And there's a bunch of things I want to do. Plus, I want to carve out, you know, an extra 48 hours in every day so I have time to keep that blog going. But, you know, the interesting thing is that blog gets hits, and I haven't updated that, since the 2005 season.
Now, has anyone else updated it?
Nope, it's just me.
So what turned me on about Eurekster, I mean, it has some problems with regard to how we look at this marketplace, but what I liked about it was that it was trying to let you have a mechanism to have a whole bunch of people go out and do searches and correlate that information in a shared space. So, I mean, at least that's what I took away from it. So that through the Swiki, you would be posting the results of your search. Does that make sense?
That's really not how I saw it, but I absolutely understand that perception of it. I had seen it more as a device to centralize search results and narrow them down so that it's not the full everything out there algorithm as much as it's the here's what we want people looking at, look at this. Because what I'm allowed to do on mine, and this is one of the things that I found initially very attractive about it, I can say, yes, I want this word in my Swiki. No, I don't want this word. And I can accept what people suggest I use. I can, you know, accept and I can accept and include, or reject and refuse items that people have suggested. I found that very attractive, but it's just that I find it clunky and difficult to use.
Interesting. In thinking about this idea of in terms of the personal RFP, I've been thinking of, you know, when you craft your personal RFP and you drop it into the cloud, if you will. I've been thinking of that as a market space, and that, you know, any vendor or some subset of filtered vendors could respond to your request for a proposal. But talking about the Internet Village or the VRM Commons seems to me, you know, sharing some sort of shopping experience would be valuable. However, you don't necessarily want everyone to always see what you're shopping for.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's some boundary in which, and sometimes you might want help from some people, but you don't want everyone to be, you know, helping you.
Well, the equivalent of an on-off switch needs to be present at all times. Do you wish to share this transaction? Is this a public knowledge transaction or not? And that mechanism needs to be absolutely secure and have an unquestionable level of trust. Otherwise, it'll stop working as an instrument or a vehicle for regular Janes and Joes out there.
Right, and I think identity has a clear role to play in that.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what I like is the ability to, or you know, and I don't know how it would work in a user interface level, but just conceptually, I could see, you know, if someone else is shopping for the same thing, and I could know that five other people sort of have posted similar RFPs, it'd be interesting to be able to reach out to them and say, hey, did you look at this or have you considered this or whatever, and have a conversation about that thing that all five of you are shopping for, which would be a different group than, you know, dynamics about who I know or who wants to sell me that thing, all of which hopefully in some magical way that I don't understand yet, you know, we could fluidly specify as we're shopping who we might want to talk to.
And that it not be game. Because, you know, I can never remember the name of the product. I'm sure I've, you know, subconsciously blocked it out. But you might recall that there was the shill, you know, blog, use bloggers as shills campaign. And
right. Paper post.
Paper post. Yeah, but I mean that's a new and nicer variation on what were some, you know, what we'll call name bloggers, if such a thing exists, who were basically shilling for a variety of products. And whether they used the product, cared for the product or not, they were just shilling for them. And here, the same concern exists of, are these trusted users, are these, you know, these people that you would interact with when, you know, you and they have the same RFP or have an RFP in a similar category. The question is, are they really, you know, real people, are their viewpoints credible, or is this just, you know, if you're shopping for a Honda, is this your local Honda dealer having its shills out there?
Yeah, it's true.
Right, and in some cases, I want the local Honda dealer to be able to help me out if I know it's the local Honda dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but
you don't want to.
Until,
yeah.
Still, you know, maybe be able to answer very specific questions.
Oh, sure. And the other thing too is that if it's local, you can also ask other locals, you know, do you use it for service? Do you do this? Do you do that? There's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions that are attendant to the purchase. That you know, basically, in effect, you're forming that community you were talking about this way. And I just have to repeat again, trust is a huge issue with that community.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's also the timing issue. It's that, I mean, the finding those people and making sure they all know about that site or that location to be at the time when they're all thinking about buying something. Do you ever get a critical mass where there's, you know, more than one or two people in there? You know, even over a day or two period. I mean, that takes huge communication and getting that kind of ball rolling. Once it's rolling, it could be really effective. But there's a whole bunch of products that probably wouldn't get any discussion.
Right.
I mean, if you blow it out to a North America wide, yes, you can find people that are thinking of buying Honda or Acura at any given time. If you're talking in Seattle or Toronto, I mean, we're talking in a local market, the odds of finding two people that are online at the same time within a day or two of each other to help each other, that becomes, I mean, I'm sure it's possible, but I mean, how do you get that traffic up?
Right, and the more specific your particular request or investigation is, the more you have that problem.
I think mm-hmm. there's an interesting argument here to be made for management of the commons, because if we think in terms of tagging, if I write Honda New, because of where I live, I say Rockland County, and some other in effect, it's RFP tags, and I'm willing to share those, it could be that community emerges from commonality of tags.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's wishful thinking on my part or doable. Or some combination thereof. But I think that begins the concept of how a commons can emerge, because it's the commons is a construct. It's not spontaneous as in a more natural commons, but as something that would be willfully constructed in order to achieve this purpose. I think there's something here. I think we're at like the tip of an iceberg. I don't think we're, you know, at the iceberg.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, when you're specifically in this the language you've been using here about constructing a commons, are you specifically talking about the user taking actions to construct how they connect to the commons, or are you more thinking that we need some sort of commons maker? We need someone who's a market maker or who's facilitating a space.
I'm actually talking
about. That's what I thought you meant
both.
When you said construction. but the tagging seems like it might be more individual.
See, I'm talking about both. I'm talking about a trusted source that is the back end, the engine, there's a word that's escaping me, the facilitator of this. And that has to be, again, an incredibly trusted source. If such a source can be there, then as long as I can designate what is and isn't public and for general consumption, for lack of a better word, although then we're talking consumer, which gets all kinds of people angry. If I can control who does and doesn't see that and how much of that is, frankly, immediately identified with me, because I may want to do this as a general search before I join a group to discuss. But if there were an entity that was the facilitator of this, I would do the tagging, but the entity would manage the tags. I'm really thinking Delicious plus VRM plus an open sort of wiki-type common.
So Delicious, however, doesn't really manage the tags. In the sense, when I hear you say that, I'm thinking of someone who's saying, these are good tags, these are bad tags. These are tags that we're promoting. And if I understand it, Delicious and I know for a fact Flickr, it was about tagging your own stuff just so you could retrieve it. The idea of a folksonomy of shared tags sort of just happened, and there wasn't anyone really managing that per se.
Right. I do feel there's a need for a management presence in doing this. Let me be more specific about terms. I would put terms like Honda Accord. You know, I mean, in this case, I'd say I'm looking for a new Accord. I would be specific about model. I might be specific about features. I might be specific about, location is very important. Because, you know, somebody buying a car in South Carolina has very different needs than somebody on certain levels, you know, having to do with rust proofing and things of that sort, than somebody in New York. So I would designate what those tags were, because and they're really tags in my RFP, but I would be willing to, on certain levels, and I'm thinking out loud while I'm talking, on certain levels I'd be willing to have that open and for discussion and shared as a discussion. And the question is, as an individual, I don't believe individuals can manage this and process this. But I do believe if a trusted source would do this, I think there's a business case for this. And I think it goes, I mean, I keep talking about a car just because, you know, I had a car in my mind because my car is in the shop right now. But, you know, there's a lot of things. And the interesting thing is that a friend of mine and I have been talking constantly and doing that very search you were discussing. We're both in the market for additional hard drives and flash drives. And it's amazing how every day we each keep coming up with, I saw this and buy.com sent me that. And we also find it interesting that we get different offers from the same vendors. They've got us pegged differently based on our buying habits, our prior buying habits.
And in some opaque way that you can't access.
Right, I have no idea. I mean, it's amazing. Buy.com makes me offers and makes him offers, and they're not the same offers, but they're the same products.
Right. Well, you feel special.
Well, I'm not sure I feel special. I feel designated, but I don't feel...
Yeah, exactly.
I don't feel particularly... I've won all the offers.
I understand Amazon does that a lot too. The opportunity to dynamically sort of query the boundaries of the supply and demand curve are very, very appealing.
In my own case, I don't read most of the email I get from Amazon because I think they're going fishing with me as to what I want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, they definitely do. I used to get annoyed because for a while on a sort of business idea that never materialized, I was looking to get involved with a theater company, bought one or two books at Amazon, and for years. They'd be recommending me theater production books. Like, you guys, I'm done with that venture. It didn't go anywhere. Leave me alone.
Yeah. Yeah, and then if you buy something as a gift for somebody, they will. The problem with that sort of collaborative filtering, when it doesn't go the next level to say, did you buy this for yourself or did you buy this for as a gift for someone, you are now permanently marked as, you know, person who likes, I don't know.
Ballet.
Yeah, or Toad the Wet Sprocket, you know.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Nirvana. Right. It could be you just don't like grunge and Nirvana. Now they keep offering you every grunge band from Seattle. And, you know, you're an opera buff, and gee, why are they sending you this?
Right. I did eventually find a link where you could tell them to stop using certain data for making recommendations. But I think that's just an inherent problem in the whole attention economy is I guess the AI community, it's related to what's called the assignment problem.
Yes.
You know, you've got a bit of data. How do you assign its relevance to your algorithm or to, you know, how you got there?
Mm-hmm. By the way, when they're targeting you, were your prices always lower than the other guys, or were they all over the map?
It varied. I would be offered Western Digital hard drives almost always at a lower price than he would be offered them. But he would be offered, I can't remember, it's not Maxtor, it was some other name.
The competition, anyway. Yeah,
yeah, and he would get those, and he still gets those at a lower price. And I have a need for a great deal of storage, and so I'm forever, I'm always in the market for these. And so, you know, I'm sort of fascinated by the peculiar dynamic. And I mean, I'm absolutely their guy. I mean, every Sunday, some people buy this paper to read the real estate. I buy the paper to read all the computer supply ads.
Huh.
And I also go, you know, to a number of places online because I know those ads will be there.
Mm-hmm.
I also call, I don't know if any of you guys know Bob Frankston. I call Bob because Bob always knows where the best deals are on those drives.
Right. Well, I'd like to go back to the discussion about sharing of opinions and things like that, ratings and that. One of the challenges you mentioned are the sales rep for the Honda dealership that's not identifying him as a sales manager, sales rep or something, and he's in there. But the value of sharing information among communities or within a community is something we're certainly interested in. But how to motivate those folks? And there's a generational thing, maybe, in that younger people are more prepared to contribute to that sort of thing, whereas people that are highly corporate tend not to, because they, in their day-to-day business life, are held back from the legal department and various other policies within a company. And the other end of the spectrum is the 20-year-old that's buying a consumer electronics thing that he has no ramifications for what he writes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no ramifications is you know, the real fly in the ointment, I believe.
I think that's definitely true. You know, it relates to reputation networks and what we can do there. It's also why, you know, that no ramifications, I think, is also why we cuss at people in our cars.
I'm sorry, why, I missed what you said, Joe.
Why we cuss at people in our cars.
Ah, okay.
You know, they can't hear us. I mean, you know, we're really rude jerks. I mean, we may not drive it. Our vehicle may not be inappropriately moving on the road, but someone cuts me off, you know, you start yelling at them.
Mm-hmm.
They can't hear you.
I usually roll the window down and make sure they hear me.
Well, you sound like you're from New York.
Yes, I am.
I, was just thinking that experience and going, yeah, I've been all over North America, and I was just thinking of New York.
Although,
I think
if you've ever driven in Boston, you know that there's no more dangerous place in the world than Boston to drive.
Okay.
Go on, Joe. You were gonna. I cut you off. Sorry.
Yeah, I forgot where it was. I think the role of a reputation as part of identity cannot be overstated. I mean, because some of these things, in particular, when I look at these sorts of personal RFP or market space or VRM Commons interactions, I'm often thinking of privatized assertions that are authenticated via identity, so that you can know something about someone that helps you form an opinion or make an offer or what have you, but you don't necessarily need to know who that person is in particular. For example, someone who makes a comment about this product, knowing in an authenticatable way that they are a Fortune 500 IT manager, would be great. And yet, if they really are a Fortune 500 IT manager, there's a whole rigmarole to actually get them to actually say, hey, this is, you know, Bob from Citicorp.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, I think reputation...
Bob, immediately formerly of Citicorp.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, so if there was some way to sort of semi-anonymously make, you know, have some conversations in this marketplace, interact in the marketplace, where you can expose what's relevant in a way that's authenticatable, I think is really, really valuable. And I think one of those claims that would be nice to sort of be able to accrete are claims about reputation. You know, if this guy's a salesman who, you know, sees my personal RFP and somehow sets a flag or lets me know that he'd be happy to help me with this, effectively the search that I'm doing for this product, if he has a great reputation, I might talk to that salesman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But similarly, if he's someone I don't know, or if he's a salesman with a bad reputation, you know, I'd rather just keep surfing on my own. Don't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the question then comes the question of multiple identities and you know, assumed names and there's sort of some bigger legal and ethical questions that follow that.
Mm-hmm.
There's standard business ethics where, you know, you want to know you're dealing with people who are trustworthy and straightforward, but there's also the side of that says, you know, and this is a classic problem. If you worked for WorldCom or you worked for Enron, are you therefore a criminal? Well, not necessarily, even if you were in a place that did some, you know, incredibly criminal, horrible things. And, you know, there's guilt by association, and there's also people who just feel a real need for any number of reasons to disguise their identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, I mean, it's tough enough when you meet a person face-to-face to find out if they're a schmuck right off the bat. you know, so how in the world can we determine through a electronic medium that they're not a schmuck, you know, and that they're telling the truth and all those things. Because you don't even have a face print to look at or a set of activities that you've gone through with them to be able to ascertain whether they're, you know, so it's, yeah.
I like it. I like this. We're trying to determine level of schmuckitude.
That's right. How much of a schmuck are you?
Oh, yeah, it's like us. We ask our clients. We don't ask the question of vendors in our customer questionnaires. Do you provide good customer service? Because what a wasted question that is. Right. Who in the friggin' world is going to say no?
Right.
So it's a wasted question. But, you know, like to be able to get a sense of So the only way is to do measurement and be able to get opinions over a wide group of people. It really is mm-hmm. is all you can really do, because you can't ask the individual, are you a good guy? Because in their mind, of course they are.
Right.
Right. And there are a lot of ways that you could game potential systems like that, or ways that systems could be set up that are broken. Elance has been mentioned as a VRM system, which in some ways it is. It's sort of like
what
the Rent-A-Coder. Elance?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's basically just an easy way to go out and pick up freelance labor or contract work.
Right.
Not unlike the Rent-A-Coder that I think Doc had pointed to a couple months ago as a mm-hmm. as a VRM situation.
Right.
But one of the problems with the Elance reputation system is that if a vendor is so bad, and I know this because I've been through this as a client, if a vendor is so bad that you're canceling the project with them,
mm-hmm.
the only way to get back the commission fee that Elance takes is if you state that it's no fault of the vendor, and then the system retains no black mark against that vendor.
Hmm.
Wow. Talk about a double-edged sword.
Right. Hmm. So the problem for them is they don't want people canceling inappropriately.
Right.
And so I understand their economic motivation for why they structured it, but the reality is then vendors who really screw over their clients never get black marks if they actually refund everything and get the client to tell Elance, you know, it wasn't their fault.
Mm-hmm.
And the client cannot get back all of their money unless they tell Elance this.
Yeah, they've been incentivized to basically say what works for them, not say the truth.
Correct.
Right.
So, you know, that's a situation where the system just doesn't quite meet the reputational needs because it's meeting other profit-based goals. And I, you know, I think there are a lot of potential pitfalls in that in any sort of reputation system. I mean, I don't know if in particular what might not be working with eBay, but it seems like a nice model.
Well, certainly they got no shortage of input. You know, 250,000 people reading a book. You know, for that average to be 3.8 out of 5, you know, it's probably pretty accurate.
Right.
And that's a purely numerical scenario, because you never read the comments, or, you know, you drive yourself crazy by the time you got through the first 100 of them. So the written side probably isn't as valuable beyond reading a couple of them than the actual number.
But don't you find that in eBay that you have a percentage under which you will not conduct a transaction?
I don't know.
So if they have a, I mean, actually, honestly, I won't deal with anyone that doesn't have a 99% transaction rate, or you know, a positive feedback rate, because
mm-hmm.
my feeling is, you have to work to screw up. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you conduct honest business, it'll work. And if you're doing a lot of business, you know things will mess up. There's going to be a problem here and there. And then I'll look on the comments to see how deep was the problem.
And what kind of problem?
You know, mailing problems.
Right. I mean, that affects it. It could be. I mean, what kind of problem shapes how I read that negative comment?
And the other thing too is that you know that there are also some people who are just going to be disgruntled customers no matter what. People who or people who are trying to get the better of the vendor.
Right.
People, this is not the gizmo that you advertised, you said this, I got that, blah, blah, blah. And they just make difficulty. I realize that there's some degree of that. I certainly don't have any confidence in myself to spot the ones who do that, because I figure those who really work at that know what they're doing at it, getting back to the schmuckitude level. But, you know, the point is these systems become self-regulating, and trust and reputation, we ascribe our own values to them.
Right.
You know, we really do create them. So I do believe that rules, and even rules to some degree, individual rules, emerge in such a thing. I mean, I'm telling you that, you know, my threshold is 99%. If somebody isn't just a complete clean player on eBay, I don't want to deal with them. I don't care what they've got or what the cost is. Because I really don't feel I know anybody on eBay.
Right.
And since I have no actual existing relationship, I'm not about to go and try and create one. It's, you know, if that's what I want, I can go to a local real vendor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, depending on the product. I mean, some products I've only found reasonably on eBay. Like, I was looking for some glow sticks for a party I threw in college once.
Right. And I
don't know where I buy those locally, but I found them on eBay.
Listen, I understand. I, who am forever looking for storage, have found, you know, it tends to go in cycles, but I have found very good deals on Western Digital drives. And there was this one guy, I bought 5 drives from the guy, and I thought it was really entertaining that he always sent them to me without the barcode. He was grabbing the rebate. And I thought, you know, good for him. He's giving me such a good price. Whatever deal he's gotten, he deserves the rebate.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
I'd like to just, Joe, I think I mentioned this to you. I don't know if I mentioned this to you on IM the other day or not, but I would like to talk about something that is a sort of a VRM failure of sorts.
Oh, yes.
That I had the misfortune of participating in this week. And I'm just going to, you know, this is my little tale of woe, but I believe that there's something instructive in this for us to, there's something to be used as an example of what needs to be fixed and perhaps a how comes out of this. I have an ancient Motorola cell phone. I've actually been advised by people that I don't look like a hip, chic, cool, knit kind of guy because my cell phone is so ancient. But it's an old Motorola cell phone, and one of the things I like about it is that it does the things I need. I don't want it to be my... It's not my internet connection. I don't really care for it to be an internet connection. It's a phone that gets messages, and I have ESPN on it so I can see baseball scores, which is important to me. So it does everything I want. And it's a Motorola i90, and, you know, supposedly a train can roll over this, it'll still work. Last Sunday, when I got out of my car and it was all iced all over here, as I began to fall, I thought, better I don't fall than stuff around me does, and the holster fell off my belt and the phone went down. So I put it in my pocket. When I got up to my place, inside, the phone had broken, and that's a little clamshell phone, and the swivel was shot, and it really was hanging on by one of those little teeny weeny threads, you know, the little data thread, that was keeping the top and the bottom together. So I called my local guy on Monday, from whom I got the cell phone, who's someone I've known for years. I've also been in the cell phone business, and done deals with this guy. But I called him up and I said, that, you know, the phone died. I can't be without the cell phone. What can we do? What can we do quickly? And mind you, I have insurance on the phone. I could get another phone, but that'll take days, and I'm not willing to wait the days that will take. So I go to his place, and we figure, okay, the best thing to do here is to move me to this hybrid phone that will give me both Sprint and Nextel coverage so I can be on either network. And the upgrade, I've been on month-to-month for like 2 or 3 years. So they'll put me on a 2-year plan. They'll upgrade the phone. He'll charge me $40. I'll get a $40 credit, so it's a wash. And because I'm signing up for 2 years in order to get this phone, he gets the activation fee from it. It's a win-win-win situation. So his tech calls Nextel to activate this hybrid phone, and they say there's a sub-ID collision. This is a technical problem, and it will take a minimum, that's the key word, of 24 hours to fix this problem. Now, again, I can't be without my phone. And so I say, hey, can I just, you know, put the SIM card in another phone? Can I somehow have a phone while this goes on? No, sir, you can't. You have a SIM card collision. You have to be without a phone. And then they tell me If however, I go to the highest price phone in the place, other than the BlackBerry, or actually it was higher price than the BlackBerry, and it's a phone that has a million features I will never use. I mean,
right.
It's kind of like when I go shopping and I see grapefruit, I don't need a grapefruit that takes a picture. It's a grapefruit. Anyway, so there's a phone that has features I really will never use and don't need and don't want and have nothing to do with lifestyle. The only thing I like about this phone is that it's really, really, really small. And so that's a good thing. It has a great battery life. So that's $349. Again, I'll put $349 on my credit card. They'll credit it back to me, blah, blah, blah. And so we worked this out. This takes a long time to work out with the guy on the phone. But then he has to run it past his supervisor, who comes back and says, yes, they'll do this deal. However, they'll only do it if I'll do it directly with Nextel. Which means, again, it's a 2 to 3 day wait for the phone, even if they overnight it. But at this point, it's late afternoon, so I'm there Monday. I'm not going to get a phone till Wednesday. And that's, you know, provided FedEx and I are in the same place at the same time. And they won't allow Brad, my local dealer, with whom I have a relationship, whom I trust, who I know will steer me in the right direction and understands the kind of... In other words, this is a trusted local vendor. Anyway, they'll only give me this deal if I'll do it directly with them. They're pillaging me as a customer from their representative in order to do a deal. And I say to them, wait a second, are you kidding me? My phone is broken, and you're telling me I have to be out of a phone for a few days, and the only way I can get this deal, which is going to just take more time anyway, is for you to screw the guy that brought me to you? And they say, yes, that's right. I then demand to speak to his supervisor. He won't put me through. He says the supervisor will not speak to me. Now, what's fascinating here is that I really do need to have, you know, I need to manage the vendor at this point. I also need, you know, not only do I need to manage the vendor, but the middleman, the local retail contact, he also needs to manage the relationship with this vendor. What we have is a vendor trying so hard to, I don't know, screw the customer? Screw the middleman. I mean, no one's best interest is being served here except Nextel. And in fact, I'm a non-subscriber. I'm a month to month. I'm a non-contract guy. I can go anywhere else. The only reason I stay, quite frankly, is because I got this deal 5 years ago when I had been running a fleet of about 30 phones, and these guys would do anything for me for retention. And I got a great deal, and I'm grandfathered into a deal I couldn't get otherwise. And I just, you know, I never worry about using my phone. I never worry about going over my minutes. I use it very freely, and I text constantly. And so I have, you know, it's a wonderful deal. I don't have to worry about the bill. You know, the bill is the bill every month. But now my formerly indestructible phone has met its maker, which happens to be ice on the street here. Now, the ending of the story is, Brad is my buddy. He's a good guy. He says, give me that phone. He takes the phone. He opens up a box that has about 40 used i90s in them, pillages from their parts, and next thing you know, I've got my working phone. He found the swivel piece. He found some other piece that had broken. And, you know, mixing and matching, I have a phone again. Now, I no longer think I have an indestructible phone. And maybe after 5 or 6 years, these things don't. You know, I mean, you know, 5 or 6 years for a cell phone is like, you know, more generations than is to be expected. The other side of this is, if I can find something close to what I've got, I'm willing now to leave Nextel. I don't use the beep beep click to talk thing very much at all. There was a time I used it a lot, but my needs have changed in that regard. It's just simply they're driving me away, and I wonder if there's, you know, I mean, do we write this up? Do we tell them? Do we say, hey, you guys need to fix this? You know, is this representative? But, I mean, this really happened to me this week, and while I'm there, I'm thinking, my God, I should document this.
I would definitely write it up. I mean, it touches on something I mentioned before, which is that even if, as an organization, you know, at the corporate or C-suite level, you want to treat the market as a conversation and you want to honor consumers, my guess is the guy who was handling that customer service / sales call was just structurally incented badly, and so wanted to make the most he possibly could out of it.
Right.
So the organization as a living being made up of a bunch of individuals who have their own reasons to be part of that is having a hard time doing what's right for the whole organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's its own nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you see, the selling against themselves, that stunned me. And I hear what you're saying. Yes, he probably, if he does X amount of deals in this manner, something accrues to him. And yet, he's not even supposed to be in sales. He's supposed to be tech support doing this change for me. And he's the one informing me a minimum of 24 hours. And I mean, you know, we all know the great black hole of cell phone providers. Minimum of 24 hours means 3 to 15 days. And then you have to first argue with them to get the credit on your bill. I'm still floored by it. I'm like pissed off that I'm still using them as my provider.
Mm-hmm.
It is frustrating. Well, you're lucky that you had a champion there that was willing to work with you.
Yes, okay. It's kind of humorous, you know. If not for him, I probably would have been, you know, there's a Verizon, not that I really like Verizon very much, but there's a Verizon store around the corner from me. And, you know, even closer than my, you know, my buddy Brad, who I've been working with for years.
I see. Well, take that one step further. I mean, you've got this personal challenge that now you're trying to figure out who do you tell. You've told three people here and so on and so on, and, you know, this gets recorded, and so that goes out there. But it doesn't happen. Like my wife, there's a local coffee shop here, and it's in the building she works in, and it's just horrid. And she says the safety's gross. I mean, they're not clean. Well, there was a 60 Minutes type review that went on was on last night about that chain of coffee things, and it's just damning of them, and now they're, you know, people are saying, well, there was a talk show on it this morning about it, and they're saying, well, you know, is it fair for the one out of this chain? There's, you know, a couple hundred stores, and there's one guy that really does a really clean job, and his customers love him and all that stuff. So he's really what it comes down to, he's the exception in that rule. And yet, finally, it's hit the media. The media is all over it. My wife's saying, thank God, finally somebody's complained about it loud enough so that the world now hears, because this group needed to be cleaned up. I mean, there wasn't a store that she ever went into that she wanted to buy coffee, and she's just addicted to coffee. So in often cases, she just had to buy coffee almost. But it was dirty coffee, and she knew it when she'd buy it. So she avoided them like the plague. So that hit the media. So it's like mega blog. It was a big speakerphone. But, you know, how do we, and yet companies will try to block those things too. I mean, if there's a way in the world, they'll try to do it. Because they don't want that bad PR out, but it does come out now more and more with media.
Right.
I'm curious, was this Tim Hortons?
No, it was Coffee Time, which is the poor cousin to that.
Ah, okay.
They have lots of locations, but they're all not well run.
So that's interesting. What this just triggered in me is the potential. Let's say we have this ability to selectively bump into people at the checkout stand at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
However we magically figure out how to do that in a way that's non-intrusive and yet can help me make smarter buying decisions. That means we could also fairly simply apply external reputation to arbitrary vendors.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming we are integrated in Amazon, right? Assuming this is browser-based or some other sort of third-party mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
If that coffee shop or a website, and we had a reliable reputation mechanism, it doesn't necessarily just need to be about the users. It could also be, obviously, about those vendors. So when you show up at joeshardrives.com, Dean, or what have you,
right,
the system could automatically let you access reputational data for that vendor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very appealing concept.
Yeah, I think making it non-gameable is the hard part.
Yes.
Not to mention getting some sort of ubiquity or something like that. But.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of recurring themes that I'm finding in our conversations. One is you know, this reputation, another is identity, and another is being able to specify how I want to be left alone.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, part of what's come out of the public radio conversation is one of the reasons I don't give is because then I keep getting spammed with other offers.
Right.
So I don't necessarily want to get into that, but I think this idea of reputation in some sort of digital commons is maybe addresses some of these things we just talked about.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the other side of that, and obviously, I mean, I spent, for those of you who don't know, I spent the greater part of my working life in the radio business. There's this issue. Doc and I talked about this last night. There's an issue of when you join a radio station, a public radio station, are you really in fact joining them, or is that actually, are you a member, or is that just simply part of the vehicle or the transaction instrument for you to donate to that station or to somehow support that station? And then, yes, indeed, you get spam, and you also get endless, even if it's not spam, you get an endless plea for more money from them, which makes it less desirable to have interacted with them. I mean, there's a whole lot of things about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't go in, I won't start because I'll never stop, and this is also a great passion for me.
So. Well, we've been on the phone for an hour, and I actually need to sign off.
Yeah. Myself as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and these three computers will look at me saying, "Why haven't you touched us for an hour?"
I don't know if any of you might be able to get some sort of minutes or even just notes up on the wiki, but that would be great.
I'm not sure I can, because I have to tell you, as soon as we get off, I have work that's going to be on for like hours on end here.
I have time, but maybe just we each contribute a little bit over the next couple of days, sort of comments, what we can remember, maybe each a paragraph, maybe that'd be the good way to go, rather than...
I think that's a good idea.
Okay, I nominate you, Tom, to start.
I probably won't get to it until Sunday, Saturday afternoon, but okay.
Well, let's make a group effort, and I will definitely spend some time, including sort of copying over the structure of the last notes.
All right, very good.
Because there's a to-do list that I don't think we've had much progress on, but want to keep that propagating.
But for what it's worth, Chris Carfi suggested to me when he wrote me a note saying he couldn't be on the call that I, you know, hand out the – I should basically give people jobs. I'll assign tasks. But I'll table that for the moment.
Right.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. And 2 weeks from today, and maybe I'll send out the alert a little quicker or a little earlier next time. Because I know we had some people had some schedule conflicts, and we'll do it again.
All right.
All right. Thanks
so
much.
Guys.
All right. Bye now.
Here, guys.
Bye.